Are you looking for inspiring conversations about faith, film, and life? You're in the right place. Here's the host who knows the right questions to ask, Father Edward Looney.
Hey, everybody, it's Father Edward Looney, and today I am bringing you another conversation where we are talking about a sainthood cause. This is a cause that really hasn't progressed that far yet, but there has been a groundswell movement, you could say, and it's a cause that takes us to Scotland. And so it's about a young man named Joe Wilson. I kind of became familiar with Joe Wilson kind of through social media. Different pages that I followed were circulating different stories about him. There was this grotto, for example, in Scotland that I followed called the Carfan Grotto. And I followed them only because I have a great interest in grottos. My parish had a grotto. And so I'm like, oh, I wonder what their grotto is all about. And so it was through them, through another page, Sancta Familiae, that promotes Joe Wilson, that I came to know about him. And that led me to buy a book, actually. They shipped it all the way from Scotland, Joe's Faith. And it's by Jane Burns. And so Jane Burns is joining me today. We might be joined with another person from across the pond. We'll see what happens. But at least we're going to start talking here about Joe Wilson. And I want to introduce people to him. There are lots of holy people out there, and their stories should be shared and they should be known. And so this is one that maybe people in the States haven't heard of. But now I'm hoping that through this podcast and through other adventures that people will come to know the story of Joe Wilson. So thanks so much, Jane, for joining me today.
You're welcome, Father. And hello, everyone who's watching, listening.
Yeah.
From Scotland.
Yeah. So I haven't been to Scotland. I've been to England. I've been to Ireland.
Yeah.
And so I know now that Scotland is my next destination in the UK. I would actually like to do a return trip, I think. And I would like to do a few days in England, a few days in Scotland, and a few days in Ireland. So I'd like to, I don't know how you do that, but that's what I really want to do. That's on my heart. So we'll see what happens. That will be maybe in 2025 would be what I would project, but who knows. And hopefully when I'm there in Scotland, I'll go to the Carfan Grotto. And then I'll even be able to visit the grave of Joe Wilson. But so, Jane, tell me a little bit about how you became familiar with Joe Wilson. Like, are you from that community? Do you you already knew of him, or were you introduced to him? How did you come to know about this holy young person?
I actually didn't meet him when he was alive, although my nephew was in this same year at school. But I did come across the leaflet Joe's Words, which had been circulated, a number of years ago, and found it in the grotto, Carfan Grotto, which was one of Joe's favourite places. And I read it in the Glass Chapel during the exposition of the Blessed Sacrament. And during the reading of that, my immediate thought was, this young man should be a saint. This young man reminds me of St. Thérèse of Lisieux, who... the simple things of life were heart offerings to God. And Joe was like that. Joe embraced life and he found joy in life. So I came to know him through those words. And then that was years ago. And then when the association, the Joe's Faith Association, wanted a book written about his life, John Mallon approached me and asked me, would I like to do that? And so up until that point, I didn't know a lot of detail about Joe's life other than the leaflet which I picked up. So in 2020, it was, and through that, and I, by the time I had come to start writing the first draft of the book, I felt as though I had met Joe because of speaking to their parents, because of all the interviews I was doing with people who knew Joe while he was still alive. I really felt as though I did know Joe, and that helped me to get the stuff down on paper. But having been a teacher for 30 years and realising the importance of, you know, keeping young people in the church, bringing them into the church, feeling part of the church, I felt as though it was important when I was writing the book to show all the sides of Joe, to show that he was a young man who showed that it was cool to be Catholic, who could go about his life, who did everything with such joy, but at the same time, this faith that he had was an integral part of his life. And people, his peers, recognized that while he was still alive. And all the things that he did, all the goodness that he showed, manifested itself during his illness when they all gathered down at Caerphin Grotto, which was a place that Joe dearly loved, to pray for him and to pray for his recovery and get strength from that. So it was to read all about that, to hear all about that. And of course, as I said to you earlier, my nephew was in his year at school. And I remember the time that Joe was ill, and I remember the angst they felt and the things they were trying to do that are mentioned in the book, like doing the video, like post-its, like going on social media, and how he felt and the loss that they felt, but the influence of Joe, which carried on.
Yeah, so that's incredible. So you touched on a lot of different aspects there, and that you mentioned about Joe and how people gathered at Caerphin Grotto, they prayed there. So when we talk about these teenage saints or someday saints, you know, Joe doesn't even necessarily have a formal cause yet, kind of this association of looking into it and whatnot. But when we talk about them, like, I guess in my mind, when I read the biography, and I was reading this as kind of a first time reader, didn't know much, yeah, didn't know his story. I know obviously he died, but I didn't know much about him. And so I was kind of expecting like the moment where he would get a cancer diagnosis. We think about Blessed Carlo Acutis, or we think about Blessed Chiara Luce Padano these days, two teenage blesseds that lived, you know, not so far from our time, and that have a great devotion among the young people. And so I was kind of shocked when, you know, here's Joe living his life, and then all of a sudden Joe is sick. Joe falls ill and basically never recovers. Like, it's an instantaneous illness.
Yes. So it was a rare heart condition.
Yeah.
That hadn't been heard of, and you're right, basically did collapse and he never came out of the induced coma.
So I guess, you know, kind of the suddenness there, like you think, well, what does Joe's life teach us, or what does it communicate to us? And I guess I was thinking, like, well, you know, it teaches us always be ready. Like, here you had a young man, you thought he had the rest of his life, maybe he was going to go be a doctor, maybe he could have been a priest. So just to always think you always have tomorrow, and I always have next year. And really, I think Joe's story reminds us we don't always have tomorrow. We don't always have next year. And we need to take advantage of this present moment that God is giving us and to serve him now and not to delay. I think that's maybe a lesson from Joe's life.
He actually says that in his diary. He says, I know I'm going to die one day, so I must make the most of all the time that I have. So in his teens, he was aware of the fact that, you know, you don't have forever, but you have a day. And that's why one of the chapters is called Carpe Diem, Seize the Day, because that's going through all the accounts of Joe's life. That's, to me, what he did. He seized the day, and he did everything in it to the best of his ability, but with joy and with faith. And that's how he lived his life up until the age of 16, 17. Because his illness came shortly after his 17th birthday.
You mentioned that one of Joe's favorite places to pray was the Caerphin Grotto. So, yes, you know, translate that to where I live in northeastern Wisconsin. Maybe you'd say, oh, this is a young boy who loves going to the Shrine of Our Lady of Champion, a Marian apparition site. Or, you know, where I was stationed, but previously in a different assignment, there was a grotto. And so, you know, and it was in the cemetery. And maybe there would be a young boy who would go there and pray the rosary. And you'd be like, oh, that's a kid just like Joe. Or one last example is like down in a place called Briggsville, Wisconsin. Shrine to Saint Philomena, you know, maybe someone going there to this little outdoor grotto of Saint Philomena. But like, he had a predilection, a preference for these holy things. So tell us a little bit about his spirituality. Like, how did he arrive at this at such a young age? Were his parents faith-filled? Did they hand it on to him? Because we know the story of Blessed Carlo. Blessed Carlo's mother says, no, I wasn't religious at all. My boy just had the acumen for it. So what was the situation of Joe?
Joe was influenced. His parents are both faith-filled. His mother is a Catholic. His father was originally an Episcopalian who converted to Catholicism after Joe's death. But they both had faith. But he was greatly influenced by his maternal grandfather, who was his sponsor at his confirmation. And he was very interested in the simple faith that his grandparents held. He was often asking to look at his grandmother's, he didn't ever meet his maternal grandmother, to see the prayer books. He was very interested in St. Martin de Porres. He was very much influenced by the faith of his grandfather, who was a daily communicant and who talked about touching the hands of a priest, the hands that held the consecrated host. And his grandfather, and Joe was very much impressed by this. So much impressed by his grandfather's faith that he wrote an essay about it as part of his school course when he had to do a reflective essay. And he did it on his grandfather and the passing of his grandfather and how his faith had affected him. So the faith was already there, but he was showing an interest in his faith from a very early age, Father, because there's a lovely story about him making his first confession. And there were several priests there, and so the priests were dotted about the altar in various places. And all the children, who were only at the age of seven, going up and coming down very quickly, having confessed, Joe's still up there. So I think his parents made Joe either has a lot of sins to tell, but more they knew of Joe's. Joe would be like the questioning the priest. He was already at that early age, in the early stages of the sacraments, thinking about his faith, questioning about his faith, wanting to know more about his faith. So that kind of carried through. And bearing in mind, too, that his thoughts on his faith, the Joe's words, the words that became the diary, weren't discovered till after his death. And he was scribbling them in jotters in the back of school exercise books. And that's what was discovered, but only after his death, that from the age of 14, he'd begun to record his thoughts about his faith and how that was progressing.
Now, are those writings, are those published, are those thoughts, those reflections?
Those are in the leaflet called Joe's Words. I don't know if you have been sent that along with the book. I've got a lot of quotations in the book, but it started out as the leaflet I was telling you about, Joe's Words, sure. Which is free. So that's when they were just using the quotes from his book with some photographs. And that's the kind of stuff that was used on the original Facebook page, which was Joe's Faith, and has now become the Joe's Faith Association. So they were just using the quotes, and a lot of these quotes just inspired people to send in prayer requests or to comment on his faith on the Facebook page.
So you mentioned when you first learned about Joe, you said this boy could be a saint. Mm-hmm. What do his parents think about that? Like, do they realize that he was a holy kid? Maybe he should be a saint? Have you talked to them about that? What's their reaction?
His parents are very much whatever God's will is, that's what we will go with. And they knew that Joe had faith, and they saw that his faith was blossoming, but they didn't realize the depth of his thought and his spirituality until they read these diary extracts. You know, they knew that the things, obviously, because he went to the grotto to pray the rosary with his mother quite often. When he was praying for somebody, he bought a special pair of rosary beads in Lisieux, because he went to the house of St. Therese of Lisieux and was very much taken by that. And when he went into her bedroom and his mother said, you couldn't describe the awe. He said, we are standing in the bedroom of a saint. And that was overwhelming to him. So when they were buying souvenirs, he chose the coloured rosary, and that's the one that his parents still pray on to this day whenever they can.
And now, almost, you know, of course he's not canonized a saint, but some people think he will be one day. So, like, he said that about Saint Therese, and one day, please God, they'll stand in that bedroom themselves of Joe, and they'll say, I'm in the bedroom of a saint. Almost like if those words he was saying about Therese were prophetic and could be said about him one day. So so he becomes ill kind of instantaneously, and then is taken in the A&E and is in the hospital. He doesn't recover. He dies. And he dies right around Christmas. Is that right, when he dies?
The week before Christmas. The week before. His funeral was on Christmas Eve in 2011. His funeral was on Christmas Eve. And they had a week. And as his parents said, everything, having to go through that at that time when people are joyful and Christmas and coming up, and they had to go through that. And they said that they felt as though everything came together. They got the strength. One of the things that his father said is that on the morning after Joe passed away and they were going home, and there was a beautiful, beautiful sunrise. And that made his father feel that Joe was where he wanted to be. Mm. And that gave them strength, and from somewhere they got the strength to deal with that next week, to have a funeral on Christmas Eve. And in fact, when you're talking about will Joe become a saint, it was actually Bishop Devine at the time who asked to speak at Joe's Mass and said, I've always confirmed Joe, but confirming so many people, you obviously can't remember all the names. He says, but this, having heard what I've heard and witnessed what I've witnessed in this past week, this young man could be the first Scottish teenage saint, the 21st century. That was. And he repeated those thoughts at the midnight masses, because people told his parents, he keeps saying this, and he did for, you know, a long time after that. Instead, if there was a gathering of young people in the grotto, and he would say, you know, we have, there could be a saint here, Joe Wilson, and he only lived across the road. And that has an impact on young people when you're talking about someone who's lived out their life with joy and with faith, and they're thinking that he could be a 21st century saint, but he only lived across the road. And that resonates with kids, you know. And also, I can tell you another story. It's in the book. The head teacher of the school in Joe's sixth year, not long before he died, had to take the RE class. And he was trying to talk, Pope Benedict had been talking about 21st century saints. And he says, what do you think makes a saint? And they were going through all these things. He's giving the example of his ordinary things that people do, maybe little things that they do on a daily basis. Can you think of anyone you know who could be a 21st century saint? And he said the whole class turned as one and looked at Joe and said, Joe, sir, definitely Joe. And that's his peers. And didn't do it as a joke. Weren't being sarcastic, they really, really felt that Joe had qualities. And that was shortly before he died.
So he dies in 2011. Right now it's 2024. So we're over a decade later since his death. And is his memory still alive? Do people still talk about him? What's the, because obviously you're there and you've researched the book. So what is the response of people today to Joe Wilson?
They do still talk about him. They still have all the memories, which, bearing in mind, I only recorded those memories going back 3 or 4 years, and still alive. And what they're trying to do now, Alan still does, his father does talks in various schools. So they're still trying to reach out to this generation of young people to let them know that here's a young person who might inspire them in their faith and in their life as well. So you've got all the people who were Joe's peers who still talk about him. There's still the interest, obviously, in the Facebook page and in the devotionals, and people are still coming together. But obviously, in order to keep that going, the book, you know, has created more interest that what was all life come together. The Joe's words, the leaflets have been circulated around the world. I don't know, when you talk about America, there's a story in the book about an American lady who, at the time, Joe was going through the business of being in hospital, and the social media exploded. And she was so interested in Joe that she came over, met his parents, went to the graveside as well, and just was so taken with the story. So, and that was then, and this is now, and here you are in America, and you've found this story of Joe, and it's added interest to the other things that you've been reading about other causes for sainthood.
Yeah, wow. So you mentioned his grave. So this lady from America goes to his grave, meets the parents. Do a lot of people go to the grave? Like, if you're, I've not been there, so I don't know what the cemetery is like. Is it easy to find his grave? Do people leave things there? What's the devotion like as people visit his grave?
They've had a few devotionals down at the graveside, but I couldn't know. It's not something I know about current or on a regular basis who would visit. It's a huge cemetery in Motherwell. My parents are actually buried in that cemetery, Airbus Road Cemetery, and it's huge. And there's no markers or anything. I think Alan and Veronica told me, and I could be wrong, that in actual fact, along from Joe's grave is actually a statue. Now, I think it might be the Sacred Heart. But okay. there is a kind of a marker. This is a message. It might be from John, Father. I'll just. Coming. John says he's on his way to the meeting.
Oh, good. Good, good. It'll be great to have him. It'll be great to hear because John's a young person.
Yeah. He might know more about the development of the association and things that are going on that I've not been.
Yeah. So as we wait for John, what impresses you about Joe? So obviously you've immersed your life, you've studied him quite a bit. So what are your takeaways from this study and writing you've done?
My takeaway is that you know, he makes it cool to be Catholic. I was a teacher for 30 years and I know how difficult it is to get young people's interest, to get them to think about things, to talk about things. And Joe to me just made it so easy. It was just because of his personality. Everybody loved Joe. They respected Joe. Joe could talk about topics that young people might shy away from or just have definite views in the RE class. But the one thing they said was Joe didn't push his point of view. He put forward his point of view gently, and other peers respected that. And I just think he's an example of what anybody can do in their daily life, especially at a young age, the most difficult time when you're trying to figure out what you're at, where you're going. We talked earlier about Joe. Joe could have a number of ways he would have gone. Definitely medicine was the first route. He had a great admiration for St. Martin de Porres. And I just feel it's privilege. I do feel such a privilege to have written this, to get to know Joe through doing the book. I think the comment I made to somebody was, I just wish he'd been in my English class. I wish I'd taught him, because he would have been so enthusiastic and so, you know, involved in everything.
Yeah, I guess it's just one of those little marvels that you think about. And John is right here. So let's,
we're good.
John
into
the
room. Better late than not at all.
Right. So it'll be interesting how I edit this, you know. Maybe we keep it all in.
yeah, whatever. Connecting to audio. Right.
So John is joining us.
That's good. They're being held up somewhere.
Yes.
What was your impression of Joe, having read the book?
Yeah, well, again, I'm just kind of marvel at his faith, right? And that's the name of the book, Joe's Faith. But like, to think of this kid and him being at the grotto praying the rosary, to think of him, you know, at this glass chapel and adoring the Lord, like, this is a kid who had a spiritual life. And so that's impressive to me. And I guess that's, and just even you talking, you know, you wish you would have had him as a student, or you think about, we just finished our religious education season in our parish. And so I just think about our students there who don't want to be there, they're forced to be there. But here you have a kid like Joe Wilson who would have wanted to have been there, who would have lightened up the room. And so we need more Joe Wilsons, and we need his story to inspire these younger people. And
the other thing is it's a sense of fun, Father. The whole point is which I went, why I think the story is so great, because he did everything. He had a great sense of it. He loved dancing, and he was the first up on the dance floor. A lot of the stories talk about him jumping up to dance. And just a great sense of fun, always a big smile. So that kind of radiates out to people. And as you say, and it is tough. It's tough for priests. It's tough for parents. It's tough for teachers to engage young people and let them think you can have faith. It's not, you know, it's a good thing to have, and you can incorporate all these things. John, hello.
And so we have John Patrick Malin, I'm going to guess. You could correct me on your last name, but you're joining us. We've been having the conversation already, which is great, but I'm happy that you're here too, because you're a young person, right? And so I would love to hear your thoughts about Joe Wilson. I know that you promote him through your social media apostolate and things of that nature. So yeah, thanks for joining us, John. And yeah, just... tell us a little bit about your familiarity with Joe Wilson. How'd you come to know of his story? Or did you know him in real life?
Well, first of all, thank you, Father, for inviting us on here. And apologies for the delay. There's been an amazing turnout tonight in Moss End for confessions. We had to ask one of the priests, another extra priest, so three priests to hear the confessions of about 150 people.
And that's wonderful. So,
very, very busy. So it ran on a bit. And that's why I am late for this interview. So anyway.
Oh, no problem.
So your confession took that long, John, is what you're saying?
Oh, well, that's a rumor on the street. But the confession, the question you asked about Joe, I unfortunately didn't know Joe in life. He was a wee bit younger than me, and he went to another school, which is the other town from me. So we both went to Catholic schools, but the school I went to was different from his. And really... I first knew about Joe. Some of his friends I've known before Joe died, and some I didn't know. But really, I first came across him through his words in the grotto that I came across by chance around about 2012, but the year after his death. And this was before I was working in Catholic media and was a young Catholic student at university. And at that time, I was going through some difficult times with anxiety, and I used to go to the grotto for some spiritual uplift. And it was there at the grotto that I saw his diary. I'd heard of his death. I heard he was being prayed for. I heard of his illness, and a very brief illness. And so I saw his diary. I instantly thought, I'll give that a read. And it was just so profound for someone who was being a Catholic, for me, being a Catholic at university and experiencing many of my friends who were falling away from the faith. Some of them quite hostile, some of them quite apathetic. But then to find the fact that there was someone nearby me who was a Scottish Catholic, who had such a deep love for his faith, and to see that resonate was amazing to find in text. It was almost like a comfort. And not only was it a comfort as an example, but his words were a comfort to me in a time of deep anxiety, and it did help. And so I always kept that book. And we're talking 2012. I wasn't working in Catholic media until 2015, when Brian and my cousin Brian and myself founded Sancta Familia Media. So I always kept Joe at the back of my mind, his story. And it was 2019 when, reading the Catholic paper, I saw an advert for a walk in honour of Joe, and I saw his picture and instantly remembered that I've got this diary. You know, I've now got a media presence here in Scotland. Perhaps I could pay back the encouragement he gave me through his book by promoting his charity walk up Ben Nevis, it was, I think. So that's when I arranged the interview with Joe's dad, Alan, which went viral, and interest in the book grew. And it also gave me the chance to learn more about Joe and who he was as a person, not just his words. And also, what was interesting about that is that other people too who'd read Joe's words connected with me. And you could see from the impact that his words had, it wasn't just on me, it was on everyone else of all ages. And there was an evidence, as far as I was concerned, of someone who had lived a life of holiness. And there was evidence that there was a growing devotion to him, and still was devotion to him. So that's really the genesis of how I got to know Joe's story.
Now, we talked a little bit earlier about his grave. Have you visited the tomb or the grave? Do you go there often? Is that a place you go to? You went to Carfan Grotto for your spiritual uplift. Is that a place now you go?
Yes, you're correct in saying that. Since I discovered where Joe was buried, the first thing actually asked his dad is, where is he buried? I didn't know he was buried in Abel Cemetery, which is not far from me. So one of the things I did do after I'd learned about Joe in that interview was visit his grave, and I went there repeatedly to pray. And I tend to do that in the nicer weather. So that's become a kind of focus. And I've heard of other people as well going down there, because that is, of course, where his mortal remains rest.
What is the statue that's near his grave? I remember his mum telling me that there's a sacred heart.
At the end of the row where he's in, it's like the sixth row or something, there's a statue of the Sacred Heart, which is quite interesting. He had a few mentions of that in his book. So it was good to point that out, that was there. So I found it. But one of the things that they always did as a family, the Wilsons, was they grew sunflowers. So the sunflower that Joe grew, and there's a picture of Joe with the sunflowers, they reseed it every year and leave it at his grave. So it's the tallest flower in the graveyard. Oh. So you can see it. And to me, the connection with Joe and the plant, the sunflower, is quite evident, really. You know, it's a very tall flower, very radiant flower. People are attracted to it. It makes people happy and it turns towards the sun. So everything about Joe's life was in essence encapsulated by that flower, because, you know, he was tall. People were attracted to him. People thought he was radiant in his joy and his outlook. And everything he did had a focus for God. So to me, there's no better flower to mark his grave than a sunflower.
Oh, wow. That makes a lot of sense. And are there graces that have been reported, you know, through his intercession? You know, there's a young person here in the States that I had the privilege of knowing. I journeyed to Lourdes with this individual. I said mass in their home as they're dying. Like, I really think this individual here from the States could possibly one day have a sainthood cause. And so, you know, talking with the family, they say, yeah, you know, people have kind of like Joe, there's like a little kind of mini cultus, we'd say, a cult around devotion around the individual. And that, you know, some individuals prayed for the grace of meeting their future spouse. And so they really accredit it to that individual and their prayers for the grace of finding their husband or their wife or whatever. So are there any graces reported through Joe's intercession?
Well, it's interesting.
Granted that it's not formal or anything like that, but I think like little stories kind of circulate.
Well, there is. My situation is different with the Joe Wilson Association just now, because I work in media. There has to be a kind of line where there is the organic growth and that has to be respected. So I wouldn't want to give the impression that I'm exactly with the work of the committee. The committee is separate from what I do. I'm happy to pick up stories and share them about Joe, but the committee, is they work on their own. So what I do hear from them is that there are a number of favours being reported for Joe. Some of them, I think three of them, I think, or is it possibly two, are seriously, considerably medical miracles, you could call them that, if proven. So they need to be fully investigated to be proven. But the kind of key themes that seem to come up from what I hear is that Joe is very, very a good intercessor for mental health. Many people who have suffered from anxiety and depression have sought out Joe's help. Those are kind of the main kind of themes that I'm seeing. And you're seeing a lot of prayers on the Facebook page coming through. And you'll see if you follow Joe's Facebook page, a lot of people request prayers from him because they're drawn to him. But as far as I'm aware, there are two what you could say, potential miracles that need to be investigated, which have happened in the last 2 years in the diocese itself. So local to the area, people who didn't know Joe but prayed to him for a certain case. So that would be, it has to be investigated fully before any judgment is made by the church, I assume. So the church will do that.
Wow, that's incredible to hear. So, of course, just the early stages for this cause, but one that looks like there could be movement. So that's wonderful. Truly an inspiring story. How do you think young people are inspired by him? You know, so I mentioned earlier that we're a decade removed. We're like a generation removed from him now a little bit. So when people, let's say you were gonna go talk to some Scottish children and, you know, maybe they're 15, 16 years old. Why would they be inspired by him? Or what do you think they'd take away from a presentation?
Well, the thing is, I don't know what it's like in America, but for Scotland at the minute, if you identify someone who has a Catholic faith, you are essentially opening yourself to a lot of verbal abuse, a lot of mockery, a lot of insults because of the certain connotations that it has to be a Catholic in the modern world. It's countercultural. It's certainly not a popular choice for young people to make, where quite now, radically, we're seeing a lot of great increase in a lot of lies told about Catholics, in particular with pro-life issues, LGBT issues, chastity issues, where they are seen to be behind the times. So if you profess older religious faith, you're mocked. People have this kind of growing humanism where they're interested more in what science has to say, despite the fact that the church clearly has been at the forefront for science for 2,000 years, and they're surprised to learn some of the greatest scientists have been Catholic priests, etc. But anyway, that's an aside. Go back to the point of what I would say about Joe, is that Joe has walked the walk, and he did it in such a way that he maintained his Catholic faith, but also managed to be the most popular boy in the school, someone who maintains respect, someone that managed to live out his Catholic faith in love, and I'm sure he probably had many crosses with that, as everyone who tries to practice the faith has. And we see that in his diary, some of the struggles he's had and how he's been persevering. But it's to show young people that you can be a Catholic, you can be a top student. You know, you're not someone who's unintelligent, who's someone who's brainwashed, someone who's anti-science. You can be someone who is educated, aspiring for the top jobs, and also popular, but also maintain the whole linchpin of his life was his faith, his whole raison d'etre was his faith. So that's what I would take away from Joe's life story and Joe's words, is that it's absolutely possible to be, here's someone that did it, here's a young man who walked the walk, was a Catholic, is no longer here, but we can pray for him, pray to him for his intercession to help us do that.
I think John made an interesting point there when you're talking about the things that are thrown at you. Any young person who has faith and values that go against the kind of secular world in which we live. And the thing about Joe was all the accounts of him were that he did it quietly. He didn't put, as I said before, when he was in the religious education classes, they were having these serious discussions about things like abortion and euthanasia and all sorts of things. He didn't force his opinions on people. He put forward his opinions gently and with conviction. And that resonated with young people. And I think what's happened is now, if they see someone like Joe, who did this, who went about doing this, and compare that to the voices that are in their face, whether it's on social media or whether it's physically, when they're in universities and places where they're trying to live out their faith and be part of organisations like SPUC and so on, is to do it with dignity. They are doing it with dignity, and to look at the way other people who have to shout loud to tell you shouldn't be doing this. But the example of Joe was, I'm going to do it because it's part of me. It's what I want in my life. But I'm doing all these other things too. It was Pope Francis actually who was saying, we want saints who wear sneakers, we want saints who go to the cinema, we want saints who go to baseball. Mm. And to me, that summed up Joe. He did all the things that he loved. He loved tennis. His favourite thing was table tennis. He liked sport. He liked dancing. He liked fun. But he loved going to the grotto too. And all these things were just part of Joe. And I think that's his example. As John was saying, you can do all these things. That's why I use the phrase cool to be Catholic. I think Joe showed that it is cool to be Catholic, to do all these things, and you can do it. And people, all the accounts are, Father, that people respected Joe. That's why so many people turned out. That's why social media was just exploding at the time, because Joe's parents, they were overwhelmed at the way in which these messages of get well and so on went viral at the time. They hadn't heard of that before.
Yeah, so you mentioned making being cool in terms of Catholicism and such, and of course the Carfin Grotto we've mentioned a few times. I'm just wondering, could one of the two of you give kind of like a little sketch of what the Carfin Grotto is? Like, when did it start? Why did it start? Why do people go there? I'm assuming it's a Lourdes grotto from what I've seen. What's the history of this place, and why did it really become a spiritual icon of Scotland?
Well, as Joe mentioned in his book, he references a priest called Canon Taylor. Canon Taylor was the priest behind the idea of Carfin Grotto. Canon Taylor was appointed to Carfin in 1915, and he had, from a very young age, been a seminarian in France and had been exposed to the spirituality of Lourdes, and also had met the sisters of St. Thérèse in the Carmel in Lisieux, and was the first priest to translate the story of a soul into English. And he presented that to one of your presidents, Calvin Coolidge, in 1936 at the White House. But Canon Taylor, in 1922, there was a miner strike in Scotland, and the miners were very, very impoverished. They had no work, and to avoid spiritual poverty, as Canon Taylor called it, he thought he would try and recreate the experience of a Scottish Lourdes in his hometown. So they acquired a piece of land across from the church and set the men, the miners, to task from various villages all around to build up the Lourdes Grotto, which was opened in 1922. There was 2,000 there at the opening. But then, as St. Thérèse's cause progressed, as St. Thérèse was beatified and I think it was 1924, she was beatified, the Canon Taylor wished to erect a small statue of her in the grotto. But there was a bit of controversy with that statue, because many people remarked that this was a Lourdes grotto, and the statue of St. Thérèse in opposition to Our Lady would detract from the Blessed Mother. So anyway, Canon Taylor sought counsel from the sisters of St. Thérèse in Lisieux, in the Carmel, who reassured him that there's no one who did not love Our Lady as much as St. Thérèse. So put the statue up, it won't detract from her, and she will shower many graces on your grotto. And lo and behold, the statue was put in place, and the summer of that year, a quarter of a million Catholics visited the grotto from the 2,000 at the start. In a very short space of time, miracles began to occur at the grotto. We have in the archives at Carfin a huge volume of miracles that took place there. We talk about people seeing again, people walking again, and the renown for the place grew and grew and grew. So over the years, it became more than a Lourdes grotto. It became a shrine to various other saints. Many wealthier patrons, poorer people, saved up their money to embellish the grotto with statues of different saints. You've got St. Joachim and Anne. You've got the St. Pius X. You've got the Fatima Shrine. You've got Stations of the Cross, John Paul II. Mm. Up until the present day, we've even got a new statue, one of the first in the UK, of Carlo Acutis, who... Sure. Another story, of course, is I can tell you if you're interested, is said to have appeared at the grotto 2 years ago, which is an interesting case. Canon Taylor is also a very, very avid collector of relics. And I believe Carfin is the third largest collection of Catholic relics in the world after Rome and Pittsburgh in the USA, or Pittsburgh, you would call it. So we're quite amazed by what we've got here. We've got saints from all over the place. We've got shrines from over the world. And many great names have visited Carfin, you know, with Venerable Fulton Sheen, who's friends with Canon Taylor, visit in the 30s and preach. And we'll get good cinema footage of that. Venerable Margaret Sinclair visited. Many venerable cardinals and worthies and great renowned people visited over the years to Carfin. So it's steadily grown and become part of the central heart of what it is to be a Scottish Catholic. It's a focal point for us. And my grandparents met there. My grandmother was Lithuanian. They met and married there in the 30s. It's always been part of my life. It's always been part of Jane's life. So we're both kind of steeped. We would say steeped in it, if you want to say it, a Scottish expression.
Well, maybe one day a statue of St. Joe Wilson. We could hope and pray for that, a man who loved the grotto himself as well. So that's great. I love the little story. And so it's kind of like a developed property then. I'm assuming these other little votive shrine areas are scattered about the property?
Yeah, well, one of the things, just before I let Jane jump in there, one of the things I forgot to say is that Canon Taylor had dreams of recreating a basilica there, so he gradually acquired a lot of land. So a lot of land is still there and vacant because the war came, the Second World War and the Depression as well. So it kind of put a hold to that. And then he sadly died in 1963. But by that point in time, he was very, very old and not so much active as he was when he was younger. So, but yeah, the grotto is a very big area, bigger than you think. It's almost comparable in size.
Considering it's beside the main road, the one road that goes through Carfin and Ewart Hill, Father, you go in there and there is just such peace and silence at any time of the day. And it's beautiful in all the seasons. And one of the recent parish priests, Father Magaki, reopened a lot of the little areas of the grotto, which had been shut for many years with problems with flooding. So he got all of that sorted. So now there are a lot more little places, little chapels and things that you can go and go in and visit and pray in around the grotto. And then, of course, there's a reliquary that John was mentioning. It's a beautiful place. I think you would love it. I think if you came to visit, could try and send you a booklet about that. It's not the most up-to-date booklet, but of the grotto and the various shrines that are in it. Could post one of those out to you.
Oh, well, I will await to visit there, hopefully in the next year or two. It's on my list of places I want to go when I take my time away. So,
good.
Yeah.
We've got 8 Carmelites coming from the USA in June. They're coming to see the unveiling of a statue of a former parishioner of Carfin and Moss End, where I'm a parishioner, Mother Angeline, Venerable Mother Angeline, the Carmelite aged and infirm. So her postulator, Father Esposito, is coming from New York, and so is the Mother Prioress and 8 Carmelites. So we'll show them around Carfin in June the 23rd.
Oh, that's wonderful. I wrote down that name. I was going to ask you about who Venerable Mother Angeline was. So you're saying she was from Scotland, and so you're going to have a statue of her?
Yeah, so Mother Angeline was born in Ireland in 1873, I think she was born. 1893, sorry. And she moved at a very young age, 4 years of age, initially to Carfin, where she made her first sacraments. And then after a year in Carfin, she moved down to my parish church, 2 miles down the road in Moss End, where she remained for 12 years. So she left from here to become a little sister of the poor. And then she ended up in America, where she founded her own order of the Carmelite aged and infirm in 1937. So there's a huge number of homes in America, all started from Germantown in New York and the Bronx, all these different homes that she owns. So she's buried over there. And our homes, I think there's quite a still growing number of postulants and sisters in the order for the aged and infirm. So we're quite proud of her. On the 23rd of June, on her 40th anniversary of her death, she died in 1984, we're going to unveil a statue of her in our church grounds.
Oh, how wonderful. That's great. So a saint with an American connection also at Carfin Grotto. So how wonderful. I'm very delighted to have had this conversation with both of you, with you, Jane, and with John. And I will continue to follow the progress. I will watch the social media pages and just see what's going on with Joe Wilson's cause. And I'll follow with great interest the Carfin Grotto and all that's happening there too. Seems like it's a place that I must visit, and I hope that will happen real soon. So, but thank you for taking time to share about Joe Wilson. And I hope that here in the States, we can maybe grow devotion to him day by day, and people will seek his intercession, just as people are doing so in his homeland.
Thank you so much, Father.
Thank you.
Thank you for inviting us on to talk on your podcast.
If you liked today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review wherever you're listening. And don't forget to stay up to date with what Father Edward is doing by following him on Facebook, X, or Instagram at the handle @FREdwardLooney. Thanks for listening, and please join Father Edward again next time for another inspiring conversation.